Hello, and welcome to this podcast on the ISB's Conceptual Framework Project. My name is Rachel Nubley, a member of staff here at the ISB. I'm joined today by Ian McIntosh, Vice Chairman of the ISB, Patricia McConnell, an ISB member, and by Peter Clark, Director of Research. During the March 2013 meeting, the ISB continued its discussions on an early draft of a discussion paper for the Conceptual Framework. The areas discussed by the board included presentation and disclosures, with much of the discussion focused on presentation in the Statement of Comprehensive Income, and in particular when items should be presented in Other Comprehensive Income, or OCI. They also discussed measurement, additional guidance on the definition of a liability, concepts of capital maintenance, and the definitions of elements of the Statement of Comprehensive Income. The ISB also discussed how the new approach to distinguishing liabilities from equity that was discussed at the February meeting would apply to written put options on own shares. The purpose of this podcast is to provide an overview of the discussions at the March 2013 board meeting. Patricia, could we start with the discussion on presentation and disclosures, please?
They started out by discussing basic principles of presentation and disclosure and concluded that no one statement has primacy. They also concluded that information should be presented in a way that enables users to understand the linkage between the statements to provide useful information. In the financial statement presentation project, we call this cohesiveness. Regarding classification and aggregation, they concluded that line items should be based on similar properties, nature, function, and measurement basis. Offsetting will generally not provide useful information, which is a conclusion that the board has held for some time. The purpose of the notes is to supplement the primary financial statements, and the notes should focus on an entity's existing rights and obligations and changes in those rights and obligations.
Yes, that was interesting, Pat. They were saying they shouldn't be forward-looking, but there was a bit of a discussion as to when you set out risk profiles or alternatives that maybe you are being a bit discount rates, you are being a bit forward looking, but so that'll be a good debate. But the really interesting part, probably the one that most people are waiting for out of our conceptual framework, is OCI. What's in and what's out, and what does it mean? It's almost like the meaning of life. So we did have a discussion on what should be in profit and loss and what should be in other comprehensive income, and we decided that the discussion paper will discuss an approach to communicating financial performance that builds on the understanding that the profit and loss is widely used as the main indicator of the entity's performance. So people go to net profit or net loss first. And so we need to distinguish income and expense that's reported in the profit and loss from items that are presented in OCI. That's one point, and the second point is if we put something in OCI, should it be recycled, and if so, when? And I thought the paper set out some quite useful principles and guidelines for us at least to build the discussion paper upon. Let's see what people think when we get it out and they can talk about it. So there were three principles proposed in the paper and tentatively agreed, I think. The first one is that items presented in the profit and loss communicate the primary picture of performance in the period. So that sets the profit and loss statement as the primary statement. All items should be recognised in profit and loss unless presenting an OCI provides a better depiction. That's a bit of a statement of the obvious, I suppose, but it's probably necessary to say it. Recycling should occur if reclassifying results in relevant information about financial performance in that period. So you've had something in OCI, transactions have happened, and it's useful, gives relevant information by then putting it into profit and loss. And then from those principles, the paper led on to two qualifying groups of income and expenses, two qualifying into the OCI. One was bridging, so where you have two measurement bases. So for instance, you're measuring at fair value in the balance sheet, but you're putting an amortized cost type measurement through profit and loss, and the balance goes to ICI. And the recycling of those items should be consistent with the measurement basis presented in the profit and loss. The second qualifying group would be mismatched remeasurements. So where you've got an incomplete presentation of the economic phenomenon, for instance, a cash flow hedge, and that would be recycled when the two economic phenomena can be presented together with the related transaction. We also had a general discussion on whether maybe we should just have one comprehensive income statement and not have a distinction between profit and loss and OCI. I think it's fair to say that that wasn't generally well received or thought as being realistic. However, it may well be worthwhile setting it out in the discussion paper as a basis for people to think about alternatives to the proposal that's being made. So there's more work, we always tell the staff there's more work to be done, that's normal procedure, for them to come back and explain why the P&L is the primary statement and not the OCI, just really broadening that. To set out better or in more length the advantages and disadvantages of the approaches being considered. And then think about, we've got the two, we've got bridging and mismatched measurements, but think about whether there are other items that should go into OCI and why, and then again I suppose to look at whether they should be recycled. And one mention, for instance, was the pensions item that goes into OCI. It doesn't seem to fit very neatly into bridging or mismatched remeasurements at this stage.
Thank you, Ian. Peter, could we perhaps move on to the discussion the board had on measurement?
Yes, well, in February the board discussed or took the first step of the measurement discussion and talked about when different types of measurement might be appropriate. And that discussion really concentrated very much on cost and on fair value. And at this meeting, the board discussed other types of measurement. And the structure of the discussion really was to look at different ingredients that might be included in different types of cash flow-based measurement. So maybe if I sort of run down the list of the types of ingredient that were discussed in the paper. The first ingredient is what to do when you have uncertain cash flows. And for example, if you have loans, whether you would use the contractual cash flows or the expected cash flows, expected in the sense of a kind of probability-weighted estimate of all the outcomes. And there are some other possibilities as well, for example, the most likely outcome. And the paper talked about the various alternatives to be considered there. The second point that came up was for liability measurements and when you would consider the effect of the entity's own credit. In other words, the possibility that the entity might default on its debts. And that's often been quite a controversial discussion. It's sort of implicit in fair value. For other types of cash flow-based measure, it's maybe less obvious whether it's included or not. And again, the paper includes a discussion of the advantages and disadvantages. The third ingredient in the measures is the time value of money, so discounting, in other words. And by and large, the board has tended in the past to include the time value of money whenever it has a material effect. And the paper discusses that and suggests probably that would continue to be the case. The next ingredient is what we could perhaps call risk adjustments, which is what you would expect to see in a market price, for example, for the risk that the actual cash flows might differ from your expected value or from your most likely outcome. And the paper talked about that and talked about the difficulties of identifying that sometimes, but also talks about the advantages of capturing it to try and differentiate uncertain cash flows from more certain cash flows. Then there was a kind of catch-all ingredient which was labelled as illiquidity and other adjustments, and it's sort of the unknown unknowns. And basically the paper concluded that you probably wouldn't include those unless you could identify them very clearly. Then there were some more sort of overarching considerations. One of them was whose perspective should these ingredients be measured from? Is it, for example, a market participant perspective, which is what you would expect to find in fair value? Or to what extent could it be entity specific? And you might see entity-specific ingredients in, for example, value in use, as we use it today in impairment testing in IS 36, or in the fulfilment-based measure that we're proposing in the insurance contracts exposure drafts. Another question is, each of these ingredients, they could be all current estimates of those ingredients, or some of them could be locked in at inception of the contract. And again, the paper doesn't really suggest a single preference for all circumstances, but suggests that the board will need to consider the circumstances and consider which aspects of the measurement it wants to focus. And then the final factor, of course, that the board will need to consider in all these things is cost versus benefit. Some of the ingredients might be costly to obtain, some may produce more benefits, some may produce less benefits. So that's an overall factor the board would also have to weigh up when it's developing these approaches.
So where do you think we'll go from here on measurement?
Well, I think the papers are going to, and the discussion paper will suggest, first of all, going back to the February discussion, that the main driver of the measurement is how the asset is being used or how the liability is being settled. And so that's things like, do you intend to sell it by itself? Are you using it as part of a larger production process? And for ones you're likely to sell, then current market-based perspectives are more likely to be the answer. Again, though, the paper didn't actually say that if you're in situation X, the answer will automatically be A. I think it was more factors for the board to consider in each case.
Because this is all pretty new ground conceptually, isn't it? I mean, it's always been in the concepts, but it's never really been gone into in great depth before.
No, and we've tended to do it sort of project by project and ended up with rather ad hoc lists of things that are included and excluded, depending a bit on the views of the particular people who are involved at the time, I think. So putting some of this in the framework will give us a chance to think about this more systematically in future projects.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting.
Thank you. We then went to talk about the liability definition, and in particular looking at some additional guidance around economic compulsion and constructive obligations. Ian, could you talk us through that?
Yes, so this was again a very interesting discussion, and you know, there's a lot of different thoughts around these issues, and I think it's really good that we're going to be attacking them in the discussion paper. So looking at constructive obligations first, we looked at two approaches. One was to restrict them to enforceable items, and the other was to provide additional guidance, and the provided additional guidance, I think, won the day, and it was agreed that we would propose additional guidance, and that the main points of that guidance would be for a constructive obligation there needs to be a duty or a responsibility to another party. That's the first point. The second point is that the other party would benefit, and the third is that past actions indicate that the other party can reasonably rely on the entity to discharge its duty. We had quite a good discussion on the other party, and some, including myself, were worried that maybe the definition of another party might be very broad, like the whole world or the universe or whatever. And if it was that broad, well, the benefit might be easy, but reasonably relying on things like that might be a bit difficult. So I think there's some more discussion to be had on this particular item.
Although I think there was an interesting point that came up in the board discussion there, really, and I think that the focus seemed to be not so much on trying to identify which other party it was, but more on the fact that the party wasn't the entity itself or the shareholder of the entity,
yes,
but there was some other party that you could think about.
Yes, it wasn't just for the benefit of the entity
that's right.
Itself. So, you know, self-insurance and things like that would be left out. Yeah, that's right. And then we moved on to economic compulsion, and some might think there's a bit of motherhood and apple pie in some of this, but I think it is quite important that it's spelled out in the framework as well. And we noted that existing standards provide guidance on how to evaluate the substance of contractual rights and obligations. And we propose to incorporate guidance in the new conceptual framework, and the four basic points will be that you should report substance. I think people will relate to that quite well. That if there are group contracts, you could, if there are a number of contracts, you could group them together if they were designed to achieve an overall commercial effect. And of course, that's very common, that there's a number of contracts for really one transaction. You should consider all terms, whether explicit or implicit. That's probably a bit further than we may have gone in the past. And that terms that have no commercial substance should be disregarded. For instance, if it's clear from the start that the holder of an option does not have the practical ability to exercise its right, then the option has no commercial substance. Or if all options but one have no commercial substance, the one remaining option is a requirement. So you can disregard, as I say, terms that have got no commercial substance. The discussion paper will also discuss whether economic compulsion should be considered when deciding whether a claim against an entity is a liability or is part of equity. So it's a very interesting, it'll be a very interesting part of the framework when it comes through, I think.
Thank you. Patricia, could you move on to talk about capital maintenance?
Well, as you know, the current framework has a section on capital maintenance, and the concepts of capital maintenance are very important for defining profit, the theory being that unless you have maintained your capital, you haven't earned any profit. And of course, there are two concepts of capital maintenance: financial capital and physical capital. We aren't proposing to make any significant changes to the discussion on capital maintenance for the purposes of the discussion paper. Probably we won't make any changes there until we start to tackle a standards level project for accounting for high inflation, and see if that indicates that we need to make some revisions to that section of the framework.
The interesting thing about that standard, I think, Pat, is that it's aiming at high inflation, not hyperinflation, which is something we haven't done before.
And I personally think that's a good approach.
But it's a huge subject as well, capital maintenance, and I think it's something that the board has tended to sort of pigeonhole into the hyperinflation category, and so
yes.
in other standards it's tended to operate mainly on the financial capital maintenance model. And I suppose part of the thinking behind not addressing it in the DP was to avoid getting to this huge area now, when we can probably make progress with other parts of the framework.
But still, it's important to maintain it, I think, in the framework, because it is an important concept, an important financial concept.
That's right, and I think it'll provide the hook for any future work we do on it.
We also had a discussion about the elements of the statement of comprehensive income. Patricia, could you perhaps talk around that for a little bit?
Yeah, there were many board members who felt that it was important to discuss the definitions of the elements of the statement of comprehensive income, just as we did the elements of the balance sheet. Partially for the purposes to determine whether all revenue and expense was created equal, or whether there was some distinction that would help us determine what should go into profit and loss and what should go into OCI. But following the discussion of what we're going to do with profit and loss in OCI, it seems sensible to keep the current definitions with little change. So the DP is not going to propose any changes other than drafting to the current definitions.
Yes, so we won't go to gains and losses, just incomes and expenses.
That's right.
Peter, could you perhaps talk us through the next steps in the project?
Yes, so we're working all we've learnt from the very good discussions we've had with the board in February and March, and are producing the next draft of the discussion paper, which we'll bring back to the board meeting towards the end of April. And then once that's done, then we'll work towards producing the document for publication, and we're aiming to get that out in July, in early July.
Also, Peter will be having a discussion with the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum week after next on the March papers, I think, is the major focus, and anything else that they wish to bring up, so that could be interesting as well.
Mm.
In fact, we'll be asking them to look at the whole suite of papers that the board has seen so far, so the March papers plus the papers from February as well. Well, thank you very much, Ian, Patricia and Peter. This concludes our podcast on the March meeting. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.